So, John, thank you. Appreciate the kind introduction. And Jim and John, thank you for asking me to participate in this tribute to Maurice and Katie's research contributions. I know how much effort it goes into putting together a symposium like this. So I have a long-standing admiration for research contributions of Maurice and Katie, and for all they've done really to advance the agenda of the Entomological Society of America and science as a whole. And you know, when Jim asked me about presenting a talk, I thought, well, let's really work around the theme of pumping insects for information. And really, what I really wanted to stress was the TAUBA's holistic approach to advancing our understanding about insect seasonality. So I want to start out by recalling that Maurice, Katie, me, and you'll see Dave Denlinger too in this group. We were speakers at a symposium in 1999 to honor the contributions of Stan Beck, who had died in 1997. And you'll see that the title of this was Insect Photoperiodism, looking into the black box. Now, for this symposium, we were joined by Shinzo Masaki and also by Dave Saunders, Steve Rempert, and Rick Lee, who's standing next to me. This was a particularly poignant event for me because Stan Beck served as my mentor from 1962 to 1966 at the University of Wisconsin. And it was during that period that Stan's enthusiasm for research in insect seasonality and for photoperiodism rubbed off on me. And his mentorship provided a solid foundation for me to build my own research career looking into this famous black box. So in thinking about what I wanted to talk about this morning, I first of all must tell you that I actually left research in the year 2000, and at that time I became deeply involved with planning for the construction of a new life sciences center at the University of Missouri. And this center opened in 2004, and I served as the interim director for that center for 18 months, and then officially retired from the university and have started a consulting business working with architects and engineers designing the next generation of science facilities, where we're really trying to stress collaborative interdisciplinary research and design buildings that really promote collaborations. So my own research career in entomology really helped set the stage for me for doing this. And at the same time, I must tell you that when I got the invitation from Jim to participate, this provided me with a wonderful opportunity to sort of look retrospectively at my career and how my interactions with the TAUBAs had been so beneficial over the years. So I really appreciated the opportunity to get back and think some more retrospectively about diapause. So what I decided to do was really focus on the research contributions of Maurice and Katie to insect seasonality and try to put those contributions into the broader context and looking at the global perspectives of insect seasonality and then end up with talking about some examples of the relevance of insect seasonality research, which will sort of piggyback onto what Dave was talking about in his very very interesting presentation. And Dave, I'm all in favor of pushing that anti-aging research, by the way. So that's generally the thrust of what I would like to talk about. And of course, we know from previous presentations that I'll just be dealing with a small portion of the total contributions of the of the towers by focusing on insect seasonality. Now we've heard about this this work on the already about the Citation Classic, which was really a remarkable article that came out in 1976, and became a Citation Classic in 1988. And I want to point out initially that there's really no better way to demonstrate the lasting contribution to science than to point to published refereed articles and books that have been influential in guiding scientific research and thought. So such is the case for this annual review article. And I just wanted to point out that that when this came out as a Citation Classic, Maurice and Cady were presumably asked why did they think it had become a classic, and their comment was, our review has been cited frequently, probably because the topic is at the interface between insect ecology, physiology, and genetics, and it's got broad implications for evolutionary and applied aspects in all three fields. And that really resonated with me, because really that's what I've been trying to do the last few years, is to try to foster collaboration across disciplines and across different fields of science and engineering too. Now we've seen, I don't know how many illustrations we've seen of this book already, but these were all done independently, I think, so it just goes to show how important this book is to the whole field of science. I've got a slightly different twist to put on the book, so first of all, the book is successful, continues to be successful, and of course is still in print. Provides an understanding about a broad array of insect seasonal adaptations. It includes comparative information about vertebrates and invertebrates. It integrates lab and field research. It provides a strong basis for evolutionary and ecological theory. What I want to stress is the co-author of Maurice and Cady in this particular book, Shinzo Masaki, was really a giant figure in the field of insect photoperiodism. He retired in the early 90s, and is a remarkable scientist and gentleman who's made some stellar contributions. And it's just wonderful he was able to join you as a co-author on this book. Shinzo and I have a friendship that extends over 30 years, and actually two of his students, Makio Takeda and Shigeru Kikukawa, they received doctoral degrees in my lab. And in 1993, that was the year that Shinzo retired, Makio Takeda and Seiji Tanaka co-authored this book shown on the left here, Insect Life Cycles and Diapause. It really is a tribute to Shinzo when he retired from Hirosaki University. I've got a few other things to say about Shinzo as I proceed, but I just wanted to say that today we really should provide tribute to Shinzo too, because he's of his great contributions. Now, the context of the towers' research contributions, really what I'm looking at here is what does it take to be successful in conducting research in insect seasonality, and what are the relationships of the towers' contributions to those of peer researchers. So, first, I think important point to make is there's no tidy package in which to place research into insect seasonality. It truly requires a holistic, interdisciplinary approach to investigate its many dimensions. And really, it fits under the umbrella of biological complexity. We should really view research into insect seasonality from the perspective of investigating how cells, organisms, populations work to measure seasonal time. And as you can see from my attempt here to sort of indicate the fields and disciplines that researchers in this field need to draw upon, it covers a wide spectrum of science and technology, working from the molecular to the population level on the one hand, and working with tools in molecular biology all the way to climatology on the other hand. So you really got to draw upon many fields of expertise to be successful in this field. And of course, we know that the Taubers understood that to advance knowledge about insect seasonality, they understood many years ago that one had to draw upon many different fields of study. If we look at the development of insect photoperiodism in the 20th century, what we've got to do is to keep in mind that today's knowledge has been built up only over the last 84 years, just 84 years, because it was 1924 that Markovitch first published his findings showing that short days controlled the reproduction of the sexuperi in aphids. These are the wing forms that migrate to the back to the primary host in the fall. And Senzo Masaki was a speaker in a symposium on insect life cycle strategies. This was at the 16th International Congress of Entomology in Tokyo, and his talk was published in this book by Brown and Hodek that came out in 83. And what you can see he did was he plotted the number of insect species for which photoperiodic responses had been demonstrated against calendar year all the way from 1924 up to 1980, which is about the time that this was done. Notice he's got a log scale for the number of species of insects. So you can see how research in insect photoperiodism took off, and you can see the names of the pioneering researchers. And this is not inclusive, by the way, and a very important name is, in my mind, missing from this list, and that's De Wilder, who should be on here too. But this does illustrate some very important points, I think. You see Markovitch, Kogur, Andrew Arthur Lees, Danilevsky, Beck, Sanders, Tyshenko, and I've added the Taubers and Masaki. Took the liberty to modify this because I think their names should be on this, and particularly for their 1986 treatise. And if we think about pioneering treatises in insect photoperiodism, two things in my mind are particularly impressive. Here you see a listing of the dates, the authors, and the titles of the significant books, and of course I've highlighted the Tauber book in red. One reason I think these books became very influential is that the research findings were put into a broader context, and they appealed to a wide audience of scientists. The other really fascinating point is the geographical distribution of these contributions from Australia with Andrew Arthur, the United Kingdom with Lees and Saunders, Russia from Danilevsky and Tyshenko, and the US, the Taubers, Beck, and Masaki from Japan. So there's really been a worldwide, and continues to be a worldwide, interest in insect photoperiodism and seasonality. So let's talk a little bit about global perspectives, thinking here that how important it is to keep in mind that that day length really does provide the highly reliable calendar that animals use to anticipate and prepare for seasonal change, and that day length at any given latitude on Earth is at the same time today as it has been throughout Earth's history. So seasonal changes in day length forms a photoperiodic pattern across the surface of the globe. There's no better way to think about this than to get a full appreciation by looking at the these images from the NASA's Terra satellite, these so-called blue marble images, showing a photo mosaic of every square kilometer on the surface of the planet, and they reveal the four seasons in the planet's year. Looking particularly at the northern hemisphere, you can see the seasonal changes, the greening and the dying back of the vegetation, the temperate regions, and the advancing and retreating of the snow cover. So these are the global seasonal changes that insects have adapted to over evolutionary time. Now I just want to talk a little bit about the importance of one tool, that's namely the photothermogram, in studying insect seasonality and diapause. These are powerful tools to show the seasonal chronology of the life cycle of an insect. And here you see a photothermogram developed for the southwestern corn borer in southern Missouri. This is an insect that enters diapause as a fully grown larva. Shows the relationship between the critical photo period and the timing of diapause. And at this latitude, 36 degrees north, the longest day, including twilight, is a little over 15 and a half hours of light per day, which is the critical photo period. The critical photo period is that photo period that promotes 50% development and initiates 50% diapause. So you see, when temperature is accumulation above 17 degrees is plotted against day length, you see different zones here. You see the long day zone refers to the day lengths in June and early July that exceed the critical photo period, so that the larvae of the first generation don't enter diapause. And then you've got the high temperature zone, refers to the conditions in most of July and first part of August when larvae are exposed to the critical photo period. However, the temperature may not be high enough to the temperature may be high enough to override the photoperiodic effect. And then, as we move into late August, there is the short day low temperature zone, where the day length and temperature conditions induce diapause. So by making plots like this, one can make important predictions and verify life history traits, showing that at this latitude, this particular corn borer is bivolting. Now, let's give three examples of the relevance of insect seasonality research, and sort of extending the points that Dave was making. Let's first of all talk about some agronomic features. When farmers make decisions about planting, crop management, and harvesting, they must consider a range of factors that might or might not impact yield and their bottom line. So using corn production as an example, here are the factors that farmers have to take into account when they work to optimize yield. So a whole series of abiotic factors, moisture, soil fertility, soil structure, stand quality, series of biotic factors, crop variety, weeds, insects, and diseases. So here we see that, quite clearly that insects and diseases are an important factor, but just one of, shall we say, a matrix of factors that farmers, producers have to take into account. So they have to think about the big picture and work to considering all of these so-called limiting variables when they are in the process of deciding what to plant, how to implement pest management practices, and so on. So if you look at the phenological relationship between the southwestern corn borer and its primary host plant in southeast Missouri, in the right panel you see the non-diapause and diapause life cycles, and again two generations a year, as demonstrated in the photothermogram. And we also know, and it's quite an interesting feature of this insect, that the immediate pre-diapausing larva is likely to girdle the plant just above ground level. In the left panel we see the relationship between the generations of this corn borer and the rate of maturation of corn. And the corn requires about 9 weeks to complete its vegetative growth and a similar period to reach maturity. By contrast, one generation of the southwestern corn borer is completed in 6 to 7 weeks. So when you put all of this together, and again thinking in terms of the producer, there are two main advantages to planting corn early if the weather conditions permit. First, early planting will minimize the damage the first generation larvae cause to the foliage and meristematic tissues of the corn. This is because the plants have already passed their critical stage before significant numbers of larvae begin to feed. And then secondly, the early planted corn can be harvested in August before many fully grown pre-diapausing larvae have girdled the plant and caused the plants in many cases to lodge and therefore reduce yield because of inefficient harvesting. So this is just an example to show the relationship between the whole diapause seasonal phenomena and some of the issues that producers face when trying to maximize yield. Another example I think is quite interesting relates to work that was done on the dispersal of the sunflower moth. This was research conducted by Alfred Arthur and D.J. Bauer, and they provided quite persuasive evidence, in my mind, for the northerly dispersal of the sunflower moth from Texas to Saskatchewan. And as you can see from the diagram, they examined North American weather maps for the presence of sustained warm southerly winds blowing from the Gulf of Mexico towards Saskatchewan. Their results showed that the weather systems in June and July were capable of transporting sunflower moths from Texas to Saskatchewan, and of course they trapped they used pheromone traps to capture the moths in fields in Saskatchewan. So we had an opportunity to look at, that means I've got 5 minutes, yeah, okay. We had an opportunity to look at the photoperiodic response curves for the sunflower moth in Texas and South Dakota. Did this with study with Shigeru Kikukawa. And we obtained evidence really by looking at the critical photoperiods to sort of really support the Arthur Bauer idea. Here you see the photoperiodic response curves plotted for populations of the sunflower moss obtained from Texas and South Dakota, and you can see really there's no difference in the critical photoperiods that were detected for populations from both states. So since these are critical photoperiods are essentially identical, really supported the conclusion for the northerly migration, and this suggests that the moths disperse from the lower latitudes and establish transient populations. So here's a really good practical application of the use of the photoperiodic response and critical photoperiod. And finally, just a quick comment about the work done by William Bradshaw and Christina Holzerfell on the pitcher plant mosquito. They carried out a study over many years, looking at eastern North American populations. This particular mosquito lives in a highly consistent microhabitat. Migration is not an option for this species, and what they have shown through these sampling over these different periods of time, and you can see a shift in the critical photoperiod. If you look on the right panels, on the horizontal axis you've got latitude, on the vertical axis you've got the critical photoperiod. You can see that there's been a shift towards shorter, more southerly day lengths as growing seasons have become longer, and this shift was, as you can see on the right-hand side, was detectable over a time limit as short as 5 years. So they conclude there's a faster evolutionary response has occurred in northern populations where selection is stronger and genetic variation is greater than in the southern populations. So they're concluding that recent climate warming has resulted in a genetic shift towards shorter, more southerly day lengths for the induction of diapause of this particular mosquito. So here we can relate photoperiodic seasonality studies to the documentation for climate change and global warming. So after really enjoying putting this talk together, I thought, well, what are some key take-home points to make that we can learn from the Tauber's contributions? So I would like to really stress that we can learn from the Tauber's to think holistically, to draw from relevant disciplines, and to integrate field and lab information. And I think the Tauber's have shown that this type of rigorous, sustained approach to their research continues to serve them well, and as they continue to make excellent contributions in their fields, not just insect seasonality, but to biological control, systematics, and comparative and evolutionary biology. And finally, I want to just like to say that I'm indebted to Professor Stan Beck for his inspirational mentorship. He served as my doctoral degree advisor at the University of Wisconsin and got me started in this life journey in insect photoperiodism. Also indebted to my students and staff and colleagues who accompanied me on this journey, and to the Missouri Agriculture Experiment Station and the National Foundation that provided the fuel to keep the research engine running. So, thank you very much. Be happy to take any questions if there's time.
Yes. Yes.
I can just almost see him in the meeting today, how he would be so attentive and asking probing questions and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly, yeah. He was at the University of Manitoba, wasn't he, Thorstensen? Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's an interesting connection.
Yeah, there is between photoperiod seasonality and insect-plant relations. Absolutely, all connected.
The other one is choose the calling that you make that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.